Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read. The cow goes moo.
Hello, and welcome to Bookworm from KCRW, Santa Monica. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, my guest is Don DeLillo. This is the second part of a conversation initiated by a talk about his new novel, Cosmopolis, published by Scribner, but which has been bending so far into the other work as well. I wanted to begin today with something that terrified me in The Body Artist. The opening scene is mic'd almost like a Kubrick set. You hear the sounds of glasses and toast going down, clicks and pops. And it's not until the middle of the novel that we realize why. Hiding in the walls and the crawl space of this house is a gnome-like person who has learned to mimic the sounds of intimacy, and will provide for the woman who lives in the house the noises of the man she loved who lived there. And I began to think that this is, you know, a mimetic machine, more human than a tape recorder, but less than human. And I began to think how interesting that he seemed so childlike and seemed almost as if representation and our need for it was a human need, but one that requires us to become machine-like in order to be precise and accurate. It seemed as if, like, the very basis of what narration does, imitation and representation, was being thrown into a really frightening perspective.
This is true. And I think what's frightening is that this character who is given the name Mr. Tuttle, we don't know his name, he doesn't know his name, we don't know if he even has a name. This character lives in time as it truly exists. Einstein said time is a fiction, and by that I think what he meant is that our perception of time is not a genuine description of the way in which the structure of time exists in the universe around us. And this man, Mr. Tuttle, it seems to me, lives in time in an unprotected way. He's not able to protect himself as we do through our misperception of the nature of time. It's the only way we can live. He can barely live. He can't speak clearly. He moves in a jerky sort of manner. He's totally lost in the world, which could only mean that he is in the real world, not in the world we have built with our self-protective mechanisms. We don't know what the universe is truly like. This is my reading of what certain scientists, certain cosmologists seem to be saying. And so my idea was simply to try to imagine a character in this terrible dilemma. One of the things he seems to be able to do is to move forward and backward in time, although he certainly doesn't do this willingly, and I'm not quite sure if he does it physically or not. He's been living in this house unknown to the people who live there for some days or weeks, actually, which is an old idea of mine. Actually, an idea for a stage play some years ago, that an elderly couple find a man who's been living in their house for 7 years, perhaps. And over time, this idea evolved or de-evolved into the person of Mr. Tuttle, as you say, a sort of gnome-like man, a slightly overgrown elf, living unknown to the people who occupy the house. and able to imitate their voices involuntarily, but unable to say very much that makes the slightest sense at all. He's totally lost in language. I have not spoken about the body artist until this moment, and part of the reason is that I don't know how to speak about it. I'm almost in Mr. Tuttle's position in talking about such subjects as time and the future. And so I've sort of stayed away from explication until now, and I'm on the verge of stuttering as as we go on.
Well, it's very interesting to me because I think that there are certain books that almost stand, as opposed to the ones that are consciously inarticulate, there are books that stand for the inarticulate in a writer's work. For me, one of them is Joy Williams's book, The Changeling, which also has an in-between human figure making an appearance, seeming to begin a new race or reinitiate an old one. But there seems to be something that makes novels, I think of Kafka's Mole as well. These characters live in between spaces, crawl spaces. They speak a language, but they can't explain how they speak it. They know it's not their own. And it seems that they frequently are inchoate communicators of what storytelling is in some sense. Something came from somewhere that can't be accounted for, and in the account, this becomes the story. I'm interested in it because there is a kind of pre-human, post-human tone that people have talked about in different ways throughout the work, but the figure of Mr. Tuttle both overconnects to the woman he now finds himself living. He supplants her director friend, and he underconnects in that he can't tell her very much about himself or his condition. He seems to be very much a figure of the artist.
I thought of him originally as a young man of certain physical dimensions, impressively so. And almost immediately, he rejected this and became a small, nearly helpless human being. And I'm not sure I know how to say much more about him. He disappears. He appears mysteriously, disappears somewhat mysteriously, but he is real. I think readers of this book have imagined that he might be a fantasy generated by the main character who is the body artist of the title, although Mr. Tuttle also fits that category.
You see, for me, in an odd way, these characters that you've made, who have, like Eric in Cosmopolis, a world surrounding them of measuring devices, stock market quotations, instantaneous access to data, they are the opposite of Mr. Tuttle, who doesn't know how to use what he has or what it means, and he seems to be the necessary concomitant, you know, the equal but opposite, the wordless thing that is moving in its helplessness as these characters become moving in their terrible recognition that they are not helpless. You know, there's something horrifying about how post-human these people recognize that they've become in the way that Mr. Tuttle seems in some way pre or per.
He is innocent of post-humanity, totally, and reminds me at times of characters in Ratner Star who seem to struggle against language, although at the moment I couldn't name any particularly, but I just know there's some kind of affinity there.
Well, it's almost as if the solution to the language illness is autism, both in Ratner Star and in The Body Artist, and that the alternative, you see, I think, in Underworld seems to be to move back to childhood, as it is in Cosmopolis, to go to the barber shop where your father first took you. For me, when I read those things, I say, impossible, and I don't believe that Don DeLillo believes it, that to be a Steinbeck man, a neighborhood man, a naturalist, or even a Kerouac would solve the language sickness. I think that the much more rich solution for me is the solution of the mysterious object, the autistic object turned human, and that this is very hard to speak about, that the books are built around a muteness, and that this was why they couldn't ever be spoken about, and you used to prefer not to speak about them. If I understand it, you had a card that said, "Don't talk to me about it."
I don't want to talk about it. Yeah, the card really doesn't apply to such matters, but it has been interpreted that way. The Body Artist is about time. It's about language. It's about human grief, very much so, and the possible connection between grief and disconnected language. And I think some readers have interpreted that as meaning that Mr. Tuttle is not a real person. He is a figment of the main character's grief at the death of her husband. I see him as real. And as a kind of dead end, or one step beyond all human striving toward expressibility, what do we express finally at the end of it all? A kind of muteness, perhaps. That's where we begin, and that's where we end.
Well, it interests me because, you know, we're dealing with a situation of post-something or other, post-communication, post-humanity, something horrible. And the solution seemed to be in nostalgia for childhood, or a simpler state, nostalgia, taboo, or whatever. And that's why I found Mr. Tuttle, for me, much more interesting as a possibility, at least for the imagination, than the barbershop or the old neighborhood. And I acknowledge in its way that the autistic child is an equally sentimental figure, and yet it's a sentimentality that appeals to me more deeply.
I felt very much at home creating Mr. Tuttle. See, there is something about him, or there is something about me, perhaps, in him, that allowed us to respond to each other in a curious way. I had much more trouble creating the main character. Well, not that much, but he lived for me from the first moment in his inability to express things, in his elusiveness, in his difficult entrance into a room, in the difficulty he had in taking a step across a threshold from one room to the other. This was totally believable to me, and sad but brave in a curious way.
I'm speaking to Don DeLillo about His recent novels, Cosmopolis and The Body Artist, both published by Scribner's. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm. Now, it struck me suddenly with Cosmopolis that there's a kind of fiction. It's like the fiction of the parade or the funeral cortege. This is a book which takes a character who's used to, you know, sweeping across space in his stretch limo. It freezes him because not only is the president in town, but there's been the death of an internationally loved Sufi rapper, so that every kind of occasion informs against him, and he's rendered kind of motionless. Again, a stilled march. And, you know, that sense of foraging, you know, a culture going out to get its blood in the morning and bring it home to the cave at night. There's this strange quality in this book. This is the daily, this is the daily grind, the grind to a standstill. And I was wondering about that kind of emblematic feel of parade, funeral, moving through this book. I mean, you know, after all, a hearse is a stretch limo in black.
Yes, and at the funeral of the rap star you mentioned, there are in fact 36 white stretch limos carrying relatives, dignitaries, senators, congressmen, the mayor of New York, other rap stars. And for one brief moment in the novel, Eric Packer is humbled by this. He wonders about his own funeral. I think he woke up that particular morning feeling a certain intimation of mortality. And this may be the point in the novel in which it becomes pronounced. He begins to weep, wondering how he could match the grandness of this funeral. After all, the dead rap singer, Brother Fez, has four bodyguards. Even in death, Eric has only three. And the rap bodyguards are carrying combat shotguns. To have armed bodyguards, even in death, is very impressive to Eric, and something he'd never thought of, one of the few things he's never thought of. And it depresses him to know that his funeral, which he is beginning to understand may be imminent, can't even begin to match what he is watching on 10th Avenue at this moment.
There seems to be something Egyptian in the concept of the afterlife. I'm thinking, well, Chinese as well. I'm thinking of the emperor who is buried with his horsemen, or at least statues of them, hundreds of them that were dug up. There's the sense these men are, and one woman, are moving around the limousine. They're on foot. They're accompanying the limo. There is, the reviewers have seemed to be using a word, I don't know the meaning of, pharaonic. But there does seem to be an Egyptian sub-theme through this.
There is some mythological insinuations happening here. And Kinski talks briefly with Eric about immortality. There's a kind of bodilessness that Eric aspires to. That is, to end up not in a coffin, but on a disc. A disc that will ensure your immortality. And he is traveling westward throughout the entire novel. And in Egyptian lore, you live on the east bank of the river, and you die and are buried on the west bank where the sun goes down. And Kinski reminds him of this. So you're right. There's a movement west, a movement into a kind of ancient mythology, Egyptian. There are some Greek references too, I think. And perhaps Eric can be seen as an Icarus figure. that is someone extremely powerful who carries a concomitant urge toward self-destruction.
Now, he is being in some way stalked by, although physically it turns out he's stalking his assassin. He goes to his assassin's house, and we learn almost ritually, obligatorily, that they're versions of the same person. Their syntax has been constructed carefully so that we can't tell by the pronoun which one of them is being referred to by the word he. One shoots a gun but wounds himself, but the syntax proceeds as if the other has been wounded. It's a narrative strategy that I think of first in Lolita, where Quilty and Humbert meet and begin a ritual swap of pronouns. I rolled over him, he rolled over me, we rolled over us. One of them, Eric, has been studying the yen, which goes up and up. The other, the bot, which gets smaller and smaller. And there seems to be that convergence point, and yet it seems to be a ritual of convergence or an obligation toward convergence more than a discovery. In other words, something seems preordained about this.
I think Eric's entire day is preordained. I think that man had to be waiting at the end of the street and at the end of the book, and I think he does sense something, some aspect of himself in his would-be assassin. They do speak a similar language, curiously, and they do find a kind of mutual respect, oddly enough, and Eric does ultimately submit to whatever will happen. Why?
And yet there's a kind of exhausted fatedness, almost as if one expects these two characters, they're both bright enough to say, you've read Conrad, haven't you? We're secret sharers, we're, you know, at the heart of darkness. And it doesn't seem to impress them very much. It's almost as if at the end of this particular rainbow, there's not the crock of gold, but the double, and there he is. Of course he is. Welcome.
He had to be there, and I don't know that they're secret sharers exactly. I do think that they find some points of convergence toward the end, but most importantly, I think Benno Levin is the moment, is the shadow toward which Eric has been moving since the first line of the book, which is a line concerning his insomnia.
In what way? How do you mean that?
Eric, at some level, knows he's headed toward the west bank of that river as soon as the novel starts. And it's just a question of how it's going to end and who is going to engineer the last breath that he takes. And Benno Levin is there waiting in an abandoned tenement. Where else would he be? Who else would he be? There is an element of fate, and it is exhausted, because at this point, Eric himself, at 28, is an exhausted man and simply ready to stop.
His hair has been cut on one side only. He's felt that the ritual of going to the barber, I guess, having the body prepared for burial?
I didn't have that in mind. I thought only of the barber as an aspect, not directly of his past, but of his father's past. And so he's passing, as it were, through his father's tragedy into his own. And his hair, he abandons the barber chair before the barber is finished cutting his hair. I don't mean to make too much of this, but it does cause a certain asymmetry, which is one of the buried themes of the book, and something that Benno is able to point out to the far more astute Eric, that he has lost his sense of asymmetry, which in a curious way binds these two men, the fact of asymmetry, and which may have provided answers to some of Eric's difficulties, if only he hadn't forgotten this force in the world.
It's a very interesting thing. So the asymmetrical thing, the unassimilatable thing, the thing that was off balance is the prostate. And there's a certain kind of gross level of the book, that this book is going to get to this man's fundament. It means to strip him down, and it means to humiliate him. He, at first, is unaware that he's being humiliated. It's the book's job to humiliate him, not the events. The events seem to be enthroning him, and yet this book has designs on him. Why does the book want to see him dead?
I think it's an aspect of the author's respect for the character. I think the character needs to end up this way, and my job is not to prevent this from happening. At some point in the novel, Eric undergoes an examination of his prostate in the limousine itself while it's moving along 47th Street. But I don't think he is shamed by this. I think it's one of the moments of his insight in which he begins to see himself not as such an emblem of assurance and machismo, but as someone who may at some level be susceptible to self-questioning, even to shame, perhaps.
It seemed, what interested me is, of course, he's not ashamed. He's in front of a woman. The doctor is behind him. He's being palpated. He's being watched. The shame seems to be something he has to learn how to feel.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's what the book seems to be there for, in some way, I hate to say it, but to teach him a lesson.
Well, for Eric, shame is a form of enlightenment in a curious way. It's a vision into himself, something that is very hard for him to come by throughout his life, and which he begins to experience on this one last day.
I've been speaking with Don DeLillo, author most recently of Cosmopolis, published by Scribner's. Thank you, John, for joining me.
Thank you.
You can read the first chapter of Cosmopolis on the Bookworm page at kcrw.com. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special production assistance from Alan Howard. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. Archived editions of this and other Bookworm programs can be found online at kcrw.com, keyword bookworm. Cassette copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now with book, off the mouse, wow.